Welcome to the Serverless Economics Podcast, where we talk about how your company can leverage serverless to optimize operational expenses. Again, I'm Josh Proto, joined by Ryan Jones, and we are part of the leadership team at Serverless Guru, a cloud consulting company specializing in reducing operational expenses with serverless. Today, we're diving into a case study about how Realtor.com reduced their development costs and their time to launch new features by utilizing AWS. And again, if you're short on time today, you can download the episode outline in the podcast description. All right. So as the official site of the National Association of Realtors, Realtor.com is a trusted resource for home buyers, sellers, dreamers, and anyone else interested in homes, while they offer a comprehensive database for for sale properties, as well as the information tools and expertise to help people make the right home buying decision. Over the past several years, Realtor.com has experienced explosive growth. Alan Lewis, their principal architect, says, "We've seen double-digit growth for the past 18 months. More people are visiting the site and staying longer. That represents growth not only in the number of people using the site, but also in the number and complexity of new features we're developing. Supporting such growth, however, has been increasingly difficult for them." Alan Lewis then goes on to say, "We ran our website platform in an on-premises data center." Ryan, if you're running a site like this on premises, at what point where you're seeing growth do you need to start thinking about a cloud solution? Ideally, one would imagine that you should be thinking of a cloud solution in the very beginning if things start to scale dramatically. But are there any key points that happen with on-premises metrics that would point, oh, hey, I need to really start thinking about some cloud or serverless alternatives?
Yeah, great question. So I think overhead's probably the first one that comes out, as well as infrastructure costs and potentially the complexity of scaling. So I think any one of those is going to cause issues for on-premises, because typically what will happen with an on-premises server setup is that you're going to have in-house expertise of how to actually orchestrate these systems and actually build them. And then you're going to have a time that you can measure of how long did it take you to go from scratch to actually having a server running in production. And based on that, then you'll be able to take that time and then evaluate how long is that and where do we actually want to be able to scale to, a changing audience or a rapidly growing audience. Something that we've seen in the U.S., is the rapid increase needed in servers for government agencies to support different things like unemployment offices and all that stuff, for the load that they're getting. And they're still even scaling from 4 servers to 50 servers are still unable to make that happen. So you imagine that being on premises, you know, what is it? How long does it take to order another server? How long does it take to set it up? How long does it take to get everything configured? How long does it take to do all these things and also replace bad parts that might come in or different hardware failures that you might have by actually owning that physical hardware itself versus using a cloud solution where you have virtual machines or some other type of cloud computing. It allows you to basically offload the infrastructure cost to someone like AWS or Google Cloud. That's one aspect. I think the team expertise is another aspect as well. As your growth increases and you need to do more things and create new features and build new applications or even extend the ones that you currently have, the amount of complexity involved in your system is really going to start weighing down on how fast you can move. And the slower that you end up moving in those situations, the less you can take advantage of the actual market that you're actually starting to see form. And so if you're seeing a huge growth and you have the ability to scale to that growth and actually provide new features and keep people engaged that are just now interacting with your brand, you really need to capitalize on that. You need to move quickly. And if you can't, you may end up losing out to a competitor that is able to, you know, capture that market or offer a feature that you're not able to build fast enough to retain those users.
That's a really good point. And, you know, in the case study, they talk about how Realtor.com was not only evaluating the raw costs and operational expenses, as well as the capital expenditures, but also a fear about which you sort of mentioned, which is not being able to keep up with the demand of new quality features for their customers. And, you know, that may be sort of a hard thing to measure, especially when you consider that, you know, your operational costs, you know, that's on your balance sheet every single month. That's in your cash flow report. You know how much you're losing. But as far as when it comes to measuring the speed of new features, or how can a company sort of take inventory to understand that we're not being as iterative as we may want to be?
Yeah, I think you definitely need to data is the most important. So if you don't have data on how long it takes you to actually roll these features out, then you're not going to be able to iterate in any meaningful way that you can actually see that it's making progress. So definitely having a lot of companies will use different frameworks for project management, which allow them to track different feature development and how long it actually takes to do these things. So they may use something like a sprint where you put a whole bunch of tasks together over a 2-week period and you work off of that sprint and you measure how long it takes you based on estimating each task at the beginning. So each team member may estimate, okay, this task is going to take 2 hours. Then some other member on the team might say it'll take 3 hours. They average it together and they have a whole set of maybe 10, 30 tasks that are in there. And then they work through it over 2 weeks. And then by the end of the 2 weeks, they can look and see, okay, how much did we actually do? And a lot of times they'll call these hour estimates also story points. And they'll say, how many story points did this take? Or how many story points we're able to move through in 2 weeks. And then based on that number, you can really get an idea for how fast you're able to move. So, you know, if you think about, you know, every single story, like the amount of story points that you're actually using up in that time, based on the amount of features that you're releasing, there's a cost factor to that. Because let's say one feature took, it actually required or took, let's say 6 hours to do. And let's say that you could increase that time to where it would only take 2 hours to actually do that same feature. So it's the same quality, it's the exact same implementation, everything's the exact same, except it took you 2 hours versus 6 hours. So that 4 hour cost difference ends up turning into real dollar profit that the company is able to reallocate and then use in different areas. And so what I would say in that situation is definitely track it the way that people normally do with project management strategies, and then also make sure to identify what your actual target is. Because if you're fine with the feature taking 6 hours, then that's great. If you want to hit 2 hours, then that means that you need to figure out how to cut 4 hours off of that task. And it may be increasing your processes. It may be moving to, for instance, cloud computing to basically reduce some of the operational overhead, to reduce the amount of time that certain things take to, for instance, scale. And then based on that, once you have an idea for what all these different factors are, then you can make those adjustments and then go from there.
That's a really good framework for measuring those things. That's definitely a good point. And it seems like, the Realtor.com was using some sort of system in order to figure out that they were lacking in that department. Another need that the case study goes on to say is an aspect they were looking to shift was that their customers needed to change their ad campaigns in real time and not have to wait for the days or weeks that it would take with the on-premises system. And this required Realtor.com to evolve from a process of batch processing to real-time processing. And very briefly, could you sort of explain the difference between like batch processing and real-time processing?
So batch processing is actually something that companies use a lot of times to run things like nightly batches, is what they'll call them. And it's basically on older systems, the way that they would kind of run through a daily amount of changes is they would run this single process at the end of the day, which would then run through all the changes that have been stored up over that day, and then actually one by one go through them and then take some action. And that's probably the simplest way that you think about it. So when it comes to real time, you're no longer having to wait till the end of the day, or you're no longer having to wait for 3 days for it to actually run. And so the system is able to update and change in real time. And we've seen this before working with Serverless Guru and doing some consulting projects where we work with a very old company that was trying to basically change their core architecture that supported multiple different, hundreds of thousands of client or customers across the United States. And we were helping them actually move to serverless from their old system. And the things that they hit were trying to move away from kind of this batch process where, they would hit issues. But for instance, one change would have to be put into the first nightly batch. But if it was wrong, then it wouldn't be able to be changed until the next nightly batch. And then there would have to be a finalized change that happened in the nightly batch after that. And what that turned into is that one error potentially when a agent was filling out a form could end up taking 3 days to actually finalize and update in the system. And it was not because the agent was slow. It was because the system was built in that way to support that old legacy software and architecture. And so with real time, what they moved to is serverless is they were actually able to see that change happen immediately. So the second that an agent changed a form field, it would update in real time in their database, and they could see that reflected in the app. And that was just a game changer, because that just cut, you know, 72 hours off of the time to actually do the update process. And so that's a very big change.
Absolutely, that's huge. And you hit on another point, which they then go on to say was just that they had a desire to stop paying for the amount of time that their on-premises architecture wasn't being used. They had very, very, let's see, you know, from Lewis himself, he says, you know, our traffic changes frequently with peak hours in the evenings and lower traffic at night. And the website always had higher traffic on Sundays and Mondays, especially during the home buying season. And it was difficult to estimate the capacity. And if we guessed wrong, we were either not serving our customers or overpaying for unused capacity. So again, there's this, you know, I think every single case study that we go through, there's always some mention of not wanting to pay for the unused capacity of their data center. And that's a sort of an area where serverless continues to shine. Ultimately, when they decided to make the move to cloud, and not just to cloud, but move to AWS for their ad impression tracking, they decided to store and collect each bit of the impressions through Amazon Kinesis data stream. And then they were consumed by the company's internal billing system, which used Amazon Kinesis Firehose to integrate and send the data to AWS, Amazon Redshift data warehouse for analysis. And that was to capture each impression and then use the data repository for billing and auditing if necessary. And then finally, they were using EC2 instances to run the business logic for all their ad campaigns. And then once every bit of the impressions were delivered, the campaign was automatically shut down. Amazing. And then all of the information that was in the Amazon Kinesis data stream used AWS Lambda to process each event. Again, Lewis says that all the AWS services we use work together to manage the flow of data for the Turbo listings, and the company's in the process of migrating its entire website now to the AWS cloud based on the level of results and automation they were able to get through the Amazon Kinesis data stream pipeline. Have you seen Amazon Kinesis used in a similar way before with advertising, or have you used it in other ways? Is it sort of only limited to advertising in your experience, Ryan? Or would you say that there are other applications of it?
No, so Kinesis is a pretty widely used tool that allows you to process data in real time. So it allows you to scale pretty heavily out to lots of different processing units called shards. And what'll take place is that you have some source that feeds in data into Kinesis, and then you can actually have each one of those invoke Lambda functions to actually do some backend processing there, and then hand it off to either S3 or Redshift or some other database to then do additional processing from that. And you can create a whole pipeline that allows you to basically ingest data, filter it, reformat it, and then resave it, and then trigger off other processes based on that. So it's a very event-driven architecture, and it works super well. And we've seen a lot of clients from different industries. A lot of people actually use Kinesis for logging. So sometimes people will use it for doing like kind of ETL type stuff, which is extract, transform, and load, mm-hmm. Which I was just talking about with the pipeline. But other people use it just for piping logs out to, for instance, Elk, which is ElastiCache, I think it's Logstash, and then Kibana. And so those three things together create the Elk stack. And it's basically a way of visualizing and kind of searching, doing everything that you need to actually handle log ingestion and kind of going through it as a developer and also as like as a team to basically see what things are falling down, errors happening, all that stuff. And so that's what Kinesis is used for pretty frequently to do something like that. And there's a lot of patterns around that. And you actually get into other things like potentially like machine learning and where you need to process things in real time like that. Kinesis really shines in those areas. So yeah, I would say it's a pretty common use case to use Kinesis for that. Some people actually will use, and I've used this before, in place of Kinesis, I've used a DynamoDB stream. And kind of what I would do is that I would store data into DynamoDB, and then based on the DynamoDB data being stored, I would trigger a Lambda function. And then the Lambda function would check to see, was the data that just came in, was it created, updated, or deleted? And then based on that, if it was created, then I would take some action. I would do some additional filtering on it. I maybe do some image manipulation, something like that. You can imagine this, like, let's say that I have an S3 bucket that has for image storage. I drop the image into it. It triggers a Lambda function. the Lambda function then stores that record into DynamoDB with a status of pending, and it has the S3 key, which links back to that image that was uploaded. Then that DynamoDB database will then trigger another Lambda function, which will then pull in that S3 key, allowing it to pull in that image, do some processing on it. Then it stores back another status, which says maybe like cleaned up, and then stores the same, the S3 key to the new stored S3 image, which then triggers another Lambda function. And it just keeps going back and forth like that as it's moving through the different statuses. And if anything breaks, you can easily check that in your DynamoDB database. And I've done stuff like that before, and it's actually worked pretty well.
Now, whether you're using sort of a Kinesis or the DynamoDB stream, it seems like, you know, a lot of their functions are handling this mission critical data. Are there certain things you have to really look out for when you're sort of architecting that system? Like, are there fail safes? How do you sort of secure that sort of thing? Or is that sort of all handled by the service provider itself, as since it's, not your managed service, it's someone else's?
Yeah, so it's definitely, these are definitely fully managed services. I guess like one angle that you can take on that is the cost factor. I believe Kinesis is going to be billed by the shard. So you are going to get billed for that, even if it's not being used. Feel free to comment on this podcast and reach out to us on Twitter if I'm saying that wrong. But I'm pretty sure that's the case. So with Kinesis, these shards will be billed, I believe, hourly based on how much you're actually allocating. And whereas the DynamoDB stream won't have that. So if it doesn't get any data coming into the table, it won't invoke a Lambda function because there's been no data coming in. Whereas Kinesis is kind of saying like, hey, you know, make sure it's like, you know, kind of like if you went into a fast food restaurant, there's three cash registers. You're like, okay, put three people on these cash registers and wait. Whereas DynamoDB is like, okay, we don't need anybody until somebody comes up to order. And then just create that person to take the order. And then if another person comes, just create another person. And it handles all that stuff for you automatically, and it'll scale up as it's needed.
Very good distinctions. Thanks for clarifying on that one, Ryan. So since implementing those features of Kinesis and AWS Lambda, it has now allowed the customers of Realtor.com to now launch their ad campaigns in real time. And Lewis was saying that Kinesis and all the AWS analytics services allow them to create the real-time applications almost seamlessly. And they imagine that once the website migration is completely finished, the company will now have the ability to automatically manage all of their different traffic patterns, as well as pull pieces of information that will allow them to predict just how much capacity they need without knowing any other details about a specific system. As Lewis is saying, and he goes on to say that, you know, we can provision and use exactly the amount of compute we want, and that has allowed us to meet our exact needs. And finally, it's given us the flexibility that will help them save money and reduce their development costs. And another thing that I think, you know, in these case studies that pops up is, you know, the sort of the question of, is it all too good to be true? And with all of these like automatic scaling and provisioning that goes into it, you know, how much of it, Ryan, is truly automatic, and how much do you still need, you know, someone who really knows what they're doing or how to set the limits, or even like a serverless expert to go in? Like, how do you know when's the right time to get some help or invest in your own team to sort of better run these services?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that, you know, a lot of times we like to focus on the hello world type examples when we're building out when we're using different technologies. A lot of times with serverless, one of the first things, it's very easy to create a hello world project. Here's how you build an API. Here's how you host a website. And it may only take you one command, but then what happens when you need to make the SEO work? What happens when you need to add extra restrictions? What happens when you need to modify the deployment sequence? What happens when you need to add additional resources onto this easy tool that you're using because your use case has now grown past when you started, which is going to be every single application? And what people run into every single time is that as the application grows in complexity, the amount of knowledge and understanding that's required to actually implement it also grows at the same rate. And so, and sometimes at an even greater rate, because you have to stitch a whole bunch of these different fully managed services together, and you have to understand how the integrations work. And so a really big thing with working with serverless is that there's, you know, the commonly coined term that people are using as an alternative to serverless is Serviceful, because there's so many services that actually have to be used for a serverless architecture. I mean, if you look up lego.com serverless application architecture, and you look at some of the stuff that Sheen Bristles has shown on different talks that he's done, the amount of different layers in the spider web of services that are all communicating together. At first, it starts with one service, right? It's one Lambda function, and then it's a Lambda function that connects to DynamoDB, and then DynamoDB to another Lambda function, and just continues to grow out from there. So what can you do about that, right? Well, the thing that I would say, and this is something that, you know, I just recently put out a video on the Serverless Guru YouTube channel, which is talking about like the overview and history of Serverless Guru and some of my thoughts on, you know, serverless consultants and things like that. Also recently wrote an article called the case for serverless and hiring serverless consultants. Because I think it kind of gets at the heart of this is that, you know, with this problem, you know, you kind of have two options. The first option is the slow option, which is you can do it yourself in-house and you'll build up that internal expertise. And that might be what you actually want to do. You might have people that are capable in the cloud. They maybe been doing containers or virtual machines. They can make that transition. They've already been doing cloud formation infrastructure as code. It's a lot easier for them to transition to serverless themselves. And if they've been with the company for a long time, there may be less of a threat of investing a whole bunch of money and then having them leave. The other option is fast. So the fast way can also lead to higher quality as well. And that might be counterintuitive, but I'll kind of talk about that. So the fast option is now we're going to go after hiring a serverless consultant. So we've identified that moving to serverless is a really good initiative for our company. It's going to have all these downstream benefits to us. We don't have that knowledge in-house, and we want to basically accelerate. And so the ways that you can do it fast, bring in a serverless consulting company. And, you know, my recommendation would be Serverless Guru. I'm completely biased in that also, but it's, you know, for good reason. And so what I would say is that we do a couple different types of engagements that I kind of lay out real quick. One of them is we basically map out what your migration would look like. What's the context of your company? What services are you using? Or if you're not switched over to serverless yet and you're not migrating to a framework, for instance, it would be, what are you using with EC2 and containers and all these other services? Are you using a database? Is it MySQL? Is it NoSQL? Is it Postgres? And so on. And then based on that, we would map to what services make the most sense inside of the serverless ecosystem. Once we have that blueprint and this map, we would then give that to you. And that would be our initial engagement. Based on that, we would then kind of have two different courses of action. One of them is we'll build the blueprints for you. We'll help migrate a service for you. We'll create training around that. We'll train your team on it. You handle the actual implementation of it and we'll support you. That works really well for bigger clients. Other clients, they just want us to do all of it, right? They want to move fast. They want to just get it done. They want best practices implemented. They want to make sure the entire foundation is laid, and then they want to build on top of that and move forward on their own. And for them, you know, we offer the fully managed package where we basically do the entire migration. We work with your team to understand the context, and then we just take over ownership. And that one is, you know, usually that's the one that we recommend strictly because it's the one where we can guarantee the best results. And so if you're thinking about, you know, if you're hearing these different podcast episodes, hearing about the way that we communicate about serverless and what different options you might have, and it sounds interesting, but I don't know if it's right for me, I would say definitely reach out to Serverless Guru. You know, the first thing that we do is try to understand that context, and we'll give you the straight up real opinion. Should you be using serverless? Yes or no? Should you be using this framework? Yes or no? And we'll give you that insight, and we won't charge you for it.
Yeah, thank you for your insight, because I know, you know, Ryan, you're on the ground in the trenches daily, talking to clients and doing the work and gaining a lot of experience. So it's really valuable just to hear that sort of raw, unedited perspective of how does one sort of go about making probably one of the largest decisions that your company ever will make, which is architecting how all of your technology services are going to work together. In that, really, you know, I've seen when talking to people, you know, is tied up in a lot of fear, and it's tied up in a lot of, you know, a lot of the unknown. And that can be scary to jump in. But thankfully, you know, thanks to, you know, the internet, and I think the serverless community, as well as Serverless Guru and you and us, you know, you don't have to go about that alone anymore. And one of the reasons why we focus on these case studies is to show, you know, you're not the only one who's made this decision. There's been plenty of other companies who have taken the leap before and have had found tremendous, tremendous success. And I think the Realtor.com case study that we just went over, you know, is maybe one of my favorites because it really talks about how you can amass all of this information particularly their advertising information, and use it for, you know, get down to the very foundations of, well, what does this mean for our company, and make some actionable decisions from all that data. And for me, that's very, very exciting, trying to find actionable insights from a ton of data. Did anything else to you sort of stand out from this case study? I think you've already said most of your piece on the subject.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a good case study. It's cool to see that there's a lot of different industries that are working within serverless, real estate being a big one there, and just kind of the needs that they had to move from on-premises, then see that serverless was a good choice for them, and to actually follow through with it and make it happen. So kudos to them, and I think that's all my thoughts.
Fantastic. Well, with that, I'll just thank all the listeners of the Serverless Economics Podcast. You know, again, I'm Josh Proto, and thankfully I was able to pull Ryan Jones from Serverless Guru, our CEO and CTO, away in order to help give us some insight just on this case study. And again, please, if you have any questions about your own migration or about any of the case studies, feel free to send us an email, reach out. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review, and we will see you in the next podcast.